Welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia. Thank you for asking me to be here. I'm happy to be of service. My name is Anawa. I'm an alcoholic. And my anniversary is May the 19th of 2005. So 15 years coming up next week. And I owe that entirely to Alcoholics Anonymous and the relationship that I've developed with my creator and all of you. I'm just going to get myself off the screen. I don't like looking at myself. There we go. Gone. Lovely. So I've been asked to share it on step two, which I will certainly do. I'm going to share a little bit about my story before I do that and qualify. And so in the course of that time that I've been sober since May in 2005, I have consistently been active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had a home group. I've had a sponsor. As soon as I was able to, I was sponsoring women. I've been active in various levels of service and different areas, different districts. And I say all those things because they've all been really important for my continued recovery. And I think that it's because I have a tendency to forget of what life was like before, right? A little bit of time in between the last time I took a drink and now. And if I'm not continuously connected and touching base with people in recovery and new people in recovery in particular, the women that I sponsor, I am likely to forget, right? And I am someone who, at the point of entry into recovery was pretty far down on the scale in terms of a bottom, right? Like I just kept picking the shovel up and digging a little bit deeper. I was really stubborn, as some of you can possibly relate to. And my life has just grown tremendously. And although that is, it is amazing, it is also dangerous for me because life gets really big. And my sponsor has talked to me about not letting the life that AA gave me take me out of AA, right? Because without AA, I don't have that life. I don't have all of the amazing relationships and opportunities. And the other part of it too is that I have a lot of blessings. I have been just showered with blessings in this time that I've been sober. Trouble too, but the problem is that if I'm not touching base, if I'm not connected, if I'm not being of service, then my blessings become burdens, right? They start to weigh on me. The things that I get to do on a daily basis become things that I grudgingly do, right? And so Cynthia just announced that I'm a professor of positive psychology, which I am. I've made it my career to study things like gratitude and helping behavior and among other things. But I am someone that needs to continually remind myself to look for the good and to be grateful and to find things to be grateful for, right? And so how does that all relate to my drinking and what did that look like for me? Oh, I just told you that I hit a pretty low bottom. And so I won't spend a lot of time talking about the drinking because we all drink a lot, right? I have a lot of, I guess when I was 25 and I drank from about 13 to 25 pretty consistently. Especially in the beginning, in the first 5 or 6 years, until other stuff took over. And the reason for that is I started to get in trouble with drinking. And I realized that if I mixed other stuff in there, then I didn't tend to get in as much trouble and I didn't black out as much. And so I used some other stuff. And I spent quite a bit of time in the beginning really confused about whether or not I was in fact an alcoholic or if I just had problems with other substances and I can talk a little bit about that too when I get to that point. But for me, I remember always being really uncomfortable when I was younger. I remember being very overly concerned with what people thought of me. I remember being, I didn't know it at the time, but I know it now. I was really full of fear, like constantly, right? And my mother said I was shy. That's what she called it. She said I was very shy. And it just manifested in a lot of ways. It prevented me from doing a lot of things from, I also grew up in poverty and in a very rural area of Western Massachusetts, and everybody knew everybody there, and I could not wait to get out of there. And the first time that I drank, I did not understand how uncomfortable I was until I wasn't uncomfortable anymore, if that makes sense. Like, as soon as I felt the effects of alcohol, and I didn't have that dis-ease, this sense of just really being hypersensitive, and once that was gone, it very quickly became the most important thing in my life. Like, once I felt relief, I didn't want to have to suffer anymore. And for me, sobriety was like, being sober was suffering. And so from the time I took that first drink to when alcohol had complete and total control over my life was just a very short period of time. I'm talking like just a few months, right? So 13, 14 years old, I'm in high school, and I quickly realized that I can't do both. I can't continue to get up at 6 a.m. to go to school if I'm drinking the night before. And, I don't know that I don't remember ever making a conscious decision, but I just stopped going. Like, I stopped making school a priority. And my friend group changed. Any interests that I had just stopped. It just became my focus, like laser focus, right? Like, okay, this feels good. I feel content. I feel popular. I feel like I don't care what people think of me. And I just wanted to do it all the time. And so I chased it. And I used to think that alcohol took a lot of things away from me. It took away my education, took away relationships, took away a lot of opportunities. But I, came to a realization a little bit further on in my recovery that alcohol didn't take anything from me. I gladly gave a lot of things away so that I could have alcohol in my life, so that I could feel that sense of ease and comfort. I also am someone who has always had really intense emotions. So a lot of like visceral reactions to intense pain, often in the shape of ending of relationships. And so if you were to look at my history, anytime there was turmoil or an ending of a relationship, you would see like a falling off point where it was just a really deep, dark spiral. And there were a couple of those before I eventually got sober. But so what happened is I, at 13, 14, I wind up leaving my parents' home and I start staying with some friends. I did that for 6 or 9 months. And then my older brother had moved to Michigan, and he came back to visit, and he saw the people I was hanging out with. He saw the things that I was doing, and he said, "Why don't you just come live in Michigan? Why don't you just start over? Like, this is what you're doing is not working for you." And at that time, I really thought, I mean, I could see clearly things were not going in a good direction. And I thought if I started over, it would be better. And I moved to Michigan. I moved into a suburb of Detroit, really like fancy place, Birmingham. And I remember just feeling super uncomfortable and out of place immediately. And although I tried to not drink, it didn't work, right? I brought myself with me. I was still uncomfortable there. I started drinking and very quickly progressed and found people that drank the way I like to drink, and was working in restaurants and had like a little office job. And, my story is that I got in a lot of legal trouble. That's what happened to me. I got in, while I was still underage, I got a couple of driving under the influences. So I was just, had a very little bit of alcohol in my system, but it's elite. You can't drink and drive when you're under 21 in the States, right? Here in Canada, where I currently live, it's 19. But in the States at that time, I was, I think I was 18. And I got one, and then a month later, I got another. And I was really scared. And I knew you know, I had all these bills to pay, lawyers, court costs, probation, all these fines. Like, if any of you have ever had that sort of trouble, you know that it is really expensive to make that mistake. And then they took my license, and I'm supposed to, it was chaos. And I met someone who told me that I should go work at clubs in Detroit, and that if I did that, I would make a lot more money and I could pay everything off. And so I took that advice, and it seemed at the time, my 18-year-old self, it seemed like the perfect solution, right? Like, I don't have to get up in the morning. I can just go and be at work in a nightclub. And it's loud. I can drink while I'm there. And so that's what I did. So at 18, I started working in downtown Detroit in, you know, after hours bars and dance clubs, and just sort of like out of control all the time. I did that for a couple of years, and I honestly, I don't remember a lot of that period in my life. I remember being constantly surrounded by people. I remember really feeling alone a lot. I remember nights where I'm not really sure how I got to where I got, and nights where I was afraid to fall asleep because I didn't know what I had taken or drank or how much, and I was afraid I wouldn't wake up. I do remember some dangerous situations I put myself in, and then along with living that sort of lifestyle came, as I mentioned before, a lot of illegal issues. And for me, that looked like I had moved in with someone, a guy. I moved in with a guy that I had met, and the neighbor was a, she had, her and her husband were Sunday school teachers. They had four small children. They taught at the church down the street. They were very sweet people. At the time, I thought they were jealous of me, but they saw someone suffering, and they knew that I needed help, and so they called their cousin, who was involved in law enforcement, and I very quickly suffered some pretty harsh consequences. And so at the time that I came into recovery, so that was in about 2002, 2003, and for all of 2004 and into 2005, I struggled and I fought it, and I wasn't ready to make changes. And my attitude was, I'm just going to hold on until I get through this. And then I'm going back to doing what I want to do, because I could not fathom the idea of being sober for even a short period of time, like with nothing. Even a short period of time was just way too long. Never mind, you know, people were talking like forever, right? And so that was my plan. And thank goodness that God had other plans for me, right? My creator had bigger plans for me than that. But what changed for me is that I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a few instances of me trying to figure out if I was an alcoholic or not. And it became pretty clear that when I started drinking, I couldn't stop consistently, predictably. I could not stop. So I didn't have much control over how much I was drinking. And if I wasn't supposed to drink, I couldn't guarantee that I wasn't going to, right? Like, there were times when I was supposed to not drink or use, and I made a stupid decision and, like, you know, had to suffer the consequences. So, and that's what our book talks about, is one of, if you have one of those two things, then you could have an unhealthy relationship with alcohol, right? Like, that's how you can diagnose yourself. If when you want to, you, if when you don't want, sorry, my video just came back on. I don't want to see myself. I'm going to hide myself. There we go. Okay. If when you want to not drink and you wind up drinking anyways, and if when you are start drinking and you don't have much control over how much you drink, then there's a problem there. And that was absolutely the case for me. And so right around May the 19th in 2005, someone in AA said to me, like, you have got a lot of consequences hanging over your head. Why don't you just take the suggestions that are being given to you and do everything that we tell you to do and then see what happens, right? Like, give it, don't think about forever. Think about, like, each day is a new day to try this way and then reevaluate after 6 months or so. And if you don't like where your life is at that point, then, you know, go back to living the way you were living. You know, we'll gladly refund your misery. You can just have it all back. And that made a lot of sense to me. And so that's what I decided to do. And I put all of the principles into practice, not immediately, of course, but I found a woman who had worked the steps. She was peaceful. She was, she just seemed really genuinely happy and kind. And I asked her if she would help me. I basically just said, I need help. I don't know what I'm doing. Would you please sponsor me? And she agreed. And that really started my journey. And, you know, all of the things at the beginning of my recovery that I thought were my biggest problems wound up being things that probably saved me more than I ever could have thought possible. So one of my biggest concerns was that I didn't have a license. Another was that I had a criminal record. Another was that I had dropped out of high school in the ninth grade. And I didn't have good credit. Like it just seemed like what could life possibly have in store for me, right? And the truth is that because I didn't have a license, I had to call a lot of women and get rides to meetings. I had to do a lot of behind the scenes work to make sure I was getting to as many meetings as my sponsor was telling me to. Rides to meetings from women, because there was a period of time in the beginning there where I just kept showing up with men, and she called me out on that. I even tried to trick her. I tried to show up with a man and have him go in first and then like walk in by myself, and it didn't occur to me that she might ask me how I had got there. When she realized I was being deceitful, she looked me dead in the eye. I'll never forget this. She looked me dead in the eye. She said, if you are not willing to take my suggestions, there are a whole slew of women out there that are dying to get sober who need my help. So you need to go home and pray about whether or not I'm the right sponsor for you. And I just, by that time, I loved her and I did not want to disappoint her. And I just started crying right away. I was like, no, you're the one. You're the one. I promise. And she did me a favor that day, because becoming, letting women into my life was completely foreign to me. And I wasn't willing to do it up until that point. And that has been one of the biggest gifts that I've got out of AA, is the ability to have female friendships and not view women as competition or I have a long history of best friends pairing up with boyfriends and fiancés, and so some of them still married. So I really was distrustful of any woman, and she gave me a great gift that day in doing that. As I mentioned, the things that I thought were my biggest problems wound up being, and this is true in AA, a lot of the things that I think are problems turn out to be blessings. And that is the nature of this disease. It's right. It's the way that I think about things. It's my perception. It's skewed, right? I don't like pain. I don't like struggle. I don't like challenge. But those are the places where I grow. Those are the places where my spiritual tools are developed. Those are the places where I get experience, strength, and hope to pass on to other women who are going through it. And so I got closer to women because I had to find rides. Because I didn't have an education, I was taking some pretty rough entry-level jobs. So for the first year and a half I was sober, I was a door knocker for a home improvement company. So it was my job to go knock on your door and ask if you wanted a free in-home estimate for a roof or a siding. And I hated that job. I hated it. But because I hated it, I was pushed to go back to school, because I realized if I don't do something with myself, this is my life for like ever. And there's nothing wrong with that job. I just had a hard time with it. And I wound up, I was inside on the phone doing telemarketing for that same company for a little while, which I also hated, but that wound up being a stepping stone into my career now, which I can tell you about in just a minute. So I decided to go back to school. I was about a year and a half sober. I moved from Michigan back to Massachusetts to start school. And I did exactly what my sponsor told me to do. I traveled there early. I found a group. I found a job. I found a place to live. I met people. I got phone numbers. I signed up for school. I toured the school. I hadn't been in school since high school. It was like 12 years later at this point. I had got my GED while I was in dealing with legal stuff. So while I was incarcerated, I got my GED. And I wound up being incarcerated for a year. So it was a pretty lengthy stay where I had to think about what I had done. And I think that says something, that even when I got out of that mess, I was still like, no, no, I'm going to go back, right? Cannot imagine life without alcohol. And so decided to go back to school, started, and my sponsor told me, just do everything that you do in AA, you do that in school. You show up early, you raise your hand if you have questions, you do your homework, you sit up front, you thank the speaker, right? So for the first year, I was thanking all of my professors for the lecture. and I excelled. I did really well. And the first year or two were a bit of a struggle because I was placing more importance on schooling than I was on recovery, and things got a little precarious for a while. And my sponsor told me that I was not a student who was also an AA member, that I was an AA member who was also a student, and to keep my priorities straight, right? And she was really good about keeping me on track in that way. And I'm going to speed up just a little bit here so that I can get to talking about step two. School for me just became a constant. It was something that I really enjoyed and felt validated, especially after having left high school in ninth grade. And I just continued with it to the point where I just never left, right? So I did a couple years at a community college. I transferred to a Smith College, to a women's college in Western Massachusetts. I did a year of a post-bac at UMass Amherst, and then I applied and got into the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and did my doctorate level training there. And while I was there, I met someone in Windsor, Ontario, which is where I now live, and a job opened up at the university here in Windsor, and I applied for that job and got it, and I've been here now for a couple of years. And I am a recovery researcher. I study people in recovery. So I do surveys on things like women's relationships and early recovery. I have one about Buddhist recovery, another one about online digital recovery. So I just get to do a lot of really fun stuff and then teach people. And that is all because I followed the directions that all of you gave me. And really, it all started when I admitted that I was powerless. I had no idea what I was doing, that I didn't know what life was going to look like without alcohol, but I was willing to wave the white flag and take some suggestions that this woman that I asked for help was giving me. And a lot of them seemed absurd, right? Like, I had big problems when I came in. I needed a job. I needed a car. I needed a license. I needed money to pay my bills. I needed a place to live. And she was telling me to do things like, get on your knees and pray. Like, I didn't have any idea or conception of a God or creator or anything while I was growing up. So I guess maybe that could be a good thing, but it just seems so foreign. Like, I'd call her with a problem and she would tell me, like, I think you need to pray about this. I'm like, did you just hear what I said? Like, we're not connecting here, right? Like, I have a serious problem. How is that going to help? So I was willing to surrender and just say, you know what? I don't know. I'm gonna let someone else step in for a little while. And I heard someone explain it a couple weeks ago. It's like, if I had a management company in my life, running my life, and I wound up where I was at my bottom, I would have fired them in a minute. Boom, you're out of here. Actually, can I have a refund? Because you have not only have you not done your job, you have driven my life into the ground. And yet, because I'm using my alcoholic brain, I don't see that. I don't see all that chaos. I am trying to push forward and still think that I have it, still think that I have some semblance of control and that I can figure things out, right? And so step one for me was powerlessness, seeing that unmanageability, deciding to move forward. And then when I got to step two, my sponsor talked to me about sanity and insanity and what it meant to be sane versus what it meant to be insane. And of course, she talked to me about being insane in the sense that, you know, we do the same thing and we expect something different to happen, right? And that is insanity. And then she also talked to me about the idea that alcoholism doesn't reside. The problem is not alcohol. The problem is in my brain. Like those last couple of times that I tried to drink to show that I was not, in fact, alcoholic, I made a decision to drink when I was stone cold sober. And given the nature of how serious my problem was and all the consequences that I've now explained to you, the fact that I was capable of convincing myself that maybe I'm not alcoholic, right? Like nobody in their right mind goes through all that stuff and then thinks, well, maybe I overreacted. Maybe that's not, maybe I'll just have a couple this time, or maybe I just don't care and I'm just going to do it anyway, right? That is the type of insanity that people who have alcoholism deal with, right? Like people who are not alcoholics don't spend a lot of time wondering whether or not they're alcoholic. They just know that they're not, right? And she would throw these one-liners at me like left and right. I don't know where I got this, but I think through reading the big book and through reading the 12 and 12, I had this thought that like I knew what step three was coming up, like turning everything over, which, you know, I questioned her on that a little bit because she had also told me to not make any major decisions. And then I knew step three was coming and I hadn't, you know, I didn't have a year yet. And she was about to ask me to turn everything over. And I was like, I thought that I needed to figure out what God was in order to get to three. Like I thought two was like coming to believe, right? Coming to believe in something bigger than me and believing that that something bigger is going to restore me and I'll be able to think sanely. And I think part of the mistake that I made is I wasn't really talking to her about a lot of this. I was just like thinking about it on my own a lot. And I was having conversations with other people. And I do remember someone said to me, like, can you say for sure that there is no God? And my answer was no, I can't say that. And I don't know that I was ever really debating that, but she said, well, that's all you need. That's it. Like, just go forward. Right. And I know now looking back that there are even people that are who are agnostic and who are atheists and AA works for them too. So it's really like the hoops, as the book says, the hoops are really wide. And I didn't need to have God figured out. I mean, I still don't have God figured out, truthfully. But I was under the impression at that time that I did. And so some of the things when my sponsor finally saw what was going on and that I was struggling with this part of it, she sort of directed me to, she had me do a couple things. She had me write down a list of all the things that I would want in a higher power, like all of the things, like a wish list, kind of like what I wound up doing later for my ideals list. And so I wrote, you know, like unconditional love and understanding and support and strength and healing and all this stuff. And then when I brought that to her, she was like, well, there you go. That's your idea of what your God is, what your creator is. That is your great spirit. Right. And then she had me start writing down all the coincidences that I saw in my life, like all the times when I showed up at a meeting and I had something, you know, I'm sure at the time it seemed really big, but often it was quite small. But something major was going on in my life and I'd show up and that was the topic, or I would on a whim mention something really deeply personal to someone and they were like going through the same thing and they really needed to hear it. The page of my notebook where I started recording these things just started filling up. And that was a really profound experience for me because I had felt like through most of my life, I didn't have a lot of guidance. I'm one of six children, actually seven now, because we just found out about an oops not long ago. Thank you, 23andMe. I have an older sister, yay. I was astounded by all of the things that were coincidences. And it really felt to me like I was being led, and I had this guidance from something bigger than me. And previously, before coming into AA and getting into recovery, I always felt like my head was, I was just banging up against a wall. Things were not ever working out. I was definitely not seeing a lot of those coincidences, or God incidences, as my sponsor called them. And so, you know, the list started growing, and I was seeing all these evidence in people. And then finally my sponsor just said to me, like, you should not waste any more time trying to figure out what God is or isn't. Your butt is on the line, right? Let's just keep you moving. And that's what we did. We moved on to the next step. And in that step, I made a decision, and the decision was just to keep going, right? And what I can say is that a lot of the hope, so for me, step two is about hope, right? Hope that things can be different, hope that I can change, hope that the program is going to work for me, hope that I could possibly come to know some power bigger than me, greater than me, whether that's God or Creator or Buddha or the meetings or AA, whatever. Just general hope that my life can be different. And my concept of God and of Creator, as I like to call it now, because I am Indigenous and identify with that faith more than any. What I've come to realize is if my Creator were small enough for me to understand, wouldn't be big enough to solve my problem, which is a life-threatening disease, right? Like, my butt is on the line, and I do not need to have any of that figured out. And thank goodness that I don't feel the need that I have to have it all figured out. And so one of the gifts that I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd like to talk about is, I told you I went to, spent a lot of time in school. One of the things that I did at every one of those schools that I went to is I would seek out the counseling services or the medical director, and I would, I do this with doctors too, but I always let them know people who might come into contact with other alcoholics, and let them know that I am, used to drink a lot and I don't anymore, and that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm more than happy to talk to people who may think they have a problem with drinking. And I'm not looking to convert anybody, but it would be really helpful for me to have conversations with people about what happened to me and what things are like. And so I would give a card, and I developed a really close friendship with the medical director at Smith College, which is, it's a women's school. It's very analytical. A lot of scientists, engineers go there. And I actually wound up going to India with the medical director and four other students. We spent a month there teaching women's health at a Tibetan university. And I wound up going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting there. And I was asked to share my story, and he was there with me, and he heard my story. And that really solidified our relationship. And when we returned, actually, one other quick point that I should bring up, because it was an amazing experience that I got because of being in AA, is while I was in India, the Dalai Lama came to that university and was there for a week, and he did teachings on the Bodhisattva way of life. And so for a week, I got to sit in a massive tent with 20,000 monks and nuns and listen to the Dalai Lama talk every day about spiritual principles, and I was blown away by how similar they were to our principles. It was just a really an incredible experience that happened while I was there at Smith and in India. But when we got back, I had met the medical director's family before we left, before we went on the trip, because they were sending him off. And about 2 months later, I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw his son at that meeting, who was really excited to see me there and didn't know that I was in recovery because his father had protected my anonymity. And I brought that man to my home group, and he got connected with the men there and got a good start in recovery and was able to get sober and stay sober. So needless to say, I forged this really close relationship with his father, who was the director of medical services at that university. And I wound up being the go-to person whenever any student on campus was transported to the hospital for drinking too much, which happened quite frequently. So it was pretty much a weekly occurrence where I was given, somebody would contact me, and he was basically making anyone that got transported to the hospital for alcohol poisoning to come sit down and talk to me. So I was there for 3 years, and about two of those years I was doing this work, and I got to have some really amazing experiences and talking with these women who had never been to AA, who had never, most of them did not have any conception of God, were atheists, self-proclaimed atheists, which is fine. But when doing 12-step work and trying to present alcoholism as a spiritual disease with a spiritual solution, it can be a bit challenging. And so I got a lot of experience, and so did the women I sponsored, because I would bring them along with me. I got a lot of experience with having conversations with women who about step one and step two, and sponsoring a couple of these women too. And one of the ways that I found that I was really able to like crack the tough exterior about step two and step three is that I would talk about Alcoholics Anonymous and these steps as an experiment, right? Like, as a researcher now, it even makes more sense because I do research studies all the time. And as a researcher, I don't just have this hypothesis and then I, you know, I come up with this idea and then I claim it as true and write it up and send it out and it gets published. That's not how things work, right? There's a method to it. There's scientific method. So I have this idea. I think it's going to work. I design a study. I carry out the procedure, and then I analyze the results, and then I write up what I found, right? And hope that it's significant and it worked. But and so I tell them that AA and the steps, that's an experiment, right? The hypothesis is that this could work for you in your life. And the experiment is the steps, right? It is admitting your powerless. It is coming to believe. It is making a decision to go forward with the rest of the step. It is doing all of these things. And maybe it'll work, but you don't know until you do it. And so why don't we just try, right? And I got a lot of positive feedback about that, right? Because it wasn't really the message that a lot of them were getting. There's a lot of cross-contamination with religion and especially Christian religion in Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely nothing against that. But I do think sometimes when we're talking about specific spiritual religious aspects of specific religions in AA, it can be confusing for people who are coming in and are really have an aversion to it, or they're struggling. And I don't ever want to be a reason why someone would leave and not come back. And so I, in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I talk specifically about alcohol, and I talk in general terms about spirituality as best I can. And so I've explained to them that, you know, this spiritual experience, just as it's described in the back of our book, is really of the educational variety, which means for me anyways, it was, I didn't see the changes that was happening, but there were points along the way that I realized, based on my how I would handle a situation, so based on my response to things, I had changed. I was different. And that's what the steps are designed to do. They're designed to create a shift and a change in my personality that is sufficient to solve my problem with alcohol. They're designed to help me connect with something bigger than myself that will help me and allow me to change and to be a different person. And I do feel like a different person. I am not who I was when I came in. I am not the person that I was when I was dealing with all those consequences during the first couple of years, even the first 5 or 10 years, right? I'm constantly changing and growing. You know, I really feel like I came to, I've had to, throughout the time that I've been sober, come to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous could work in not just on my alcoholism, but also on other areas of my life. Like, one in particular was relationships. I had a really hard time with relationships. I can't tell you how many years I spent just really feeling like this one area of my life is just completely out of control. I do not know how to fix it. And my sponsor would say, like, she would say a couple of things, but one is, why do you lack the ability to accept people as they are? Because I was always trying to change people, boyfriends in particular. Why do you lack the ability to accept people, places, and situations as they are, right? And she would also say, why do you think that God and Alcoholics Anonymous is not going to work for you in that area of your life? And, you know, what I know now is that I am someone that really just struggles with intimate relationships, and I had to learn a lot about them in order to grow and to make changes in that area of my life. And I'll be darned if she wasn't right. Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles here and the steps, they do work in that area of my life as well. When I let go and I let my creator step in, and when I ease up and when I am true to myself and I get a better understanding of who I am and what I want, and then I take the steps needed to find someone that matches who I am and where I am in life and what I want, then I don't feel like I need to change them. And then relationships get a lot easier, right? And I don't typically talk a lot about relationships in my talks, but in the last 5 years or so, that area of my life has really gotten a lot better. And so for the last year or two, I have started talking a little bit more about it. Because I do think it's something that a lot of people really struggle with, and it's not discussed a lot. And perhaps meetings of AA are not specifically the best place to talk about them, but this is a women's meeting. And so I figured I should at least bring it up a little bit so that just if any of you, I mean, there's 300 plus women here, or, you know, I don't know, men too, maybe. So there are people who are struggling with that area of life. It is possible to get better and to make changes. And is it hard? Absolutely. But is it worth it? Yes. In the same way it was worth it to quit drinking and to make better choices in that area of my life, it was worth it in the area of relationships. And in fact, I just found out yesterday that I found out when I was 28 that I could not have children. And have known that and have been tested and retested. And my husband and I'm now married. My husband and I started trying to have children a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and have been through the whole process. And I just found out yesterday that we have a transfer. So we are making babies with science. So we have a transfer at the end of the month. We have a surrogate and a transfer. And if all goes well, by this time next year, I will be a mother, which is pretty incredible. And I talk about that openly too, because I feel like I have been blessed with not having it be super traumatizing. So I've known for so long, and I don't think a lot of people struggle with these sorts of issues. They don't talk about it, and people drink because they're not open about stuff. So I'm happy to have conversations with people about that if they want to get in touch with me after. But those are some of the things, like, and what I can tell you is that part of me launching on academic path was that, well, I felt like I couldn't be a mother. And so I had this weird idea where I couldn't do both. It was either like success and academics or like family. And I felt like that option had been removed from me. And so I just launched straight into like, okay, bachelor's degree, master's degree, PhD, that's it. I'm just going to go full steam here. And I didn't have to settle, and God makes a way when I show up and when I do what I'm supposed to do and do the next right thing and just always focus on being of service to others, which is what I've decided is my life purpose, is to be helpful to other people. When that's my focus and when I'm pursuing that end, other things just fall in place. They just do, right? And my only explanation for that is that the steps work. Alcoholics Anonymous works. My creator lives in my life in a way that is miraculous. And that doesn't mean things are always easy and they fall into place. Things have often been really hard. But I have adapted the concept of, even when I'm pushing through the most intense amount of pain and suffering, if it's to help someone else, if I can use that pain and suffering and that experience to help someone else going through it, then that's enough for me. And it is okay that I have to go through that pain. And every really intense experience I've gone through, I have almost immediately connected with someone who was going through the same thing or who needed help with it. And so I really do feel like that's where I get my tools, and that's where I do the most growing. And so what that has done for me is allowed me to be free of a lot of fear of dealing with pain. And I've told you, I experience emotions on a really like physical level, right? Like a visceral response to emotions, like stomach cramping, like sweat, like, and so I had a lot of fear about really intense emotions, and I don't anymore. Like I still experience the fear, but I can dismiss it a lot more. Part of that is meditation and my practice, but a lot of it is just knowing that fear is really scary when I'm looking at it, but when I walk through it and on the other side, it's like nothing. And I don't want fear to take any more of my time away from me. Right. Fear is a thief. It steals my most precious commodity, which is time. And I just don't, I've been fearful about enough things to know that when the thing happened and I looked back and I thought, well, that wasn't so bad. I spent all that time being afraid of it. Well, I could have been doing a, you know, fill in the blank, a number of other things. And I've just decided to make a conscious decision when I start to experience fear to remember that and to not waste my time in worry or concern, because I've made a decision, right? Next speaker will talk about step three. I made a decision to turn everything over. And since I did that, my life has gone a lot better than anything I could have planned. And every time I get back in the driver's seat and I am trying to run the show, my level of serenity and peace and ability to accept things just gets, it diminishes, it goes down. And I just don't want to live that way anymore, right? I got sober so that I could be happy, joyous, and free. I got sober so that I could experience relief, and I could also have a better way, an unshakable foundation, right? Prayer and meditation, first fruits of those two things, and working these steps is to create a foundation. Relief not being enough, right? It's great to feel relief, but relief only lasts for so long. I want a foundation that works and that is sturdy and that will keep me going for the long term. And that's why I continue to do all the things that I've done since the beginning, which is have a group, have a sponsor, be a sponsor, be involved in service, say yes when someone says yes, start my day with spiritual meditation books and in quiet, and end my day in the same way by thanking my creator for getting me through the day, reading my book. Like, I don't know what combination of those things actually works. It could just be four of those seven or eight things, right? But I'm not about to mess with it because it's worked for me. So I just keep doing all of them, as many as I can, consistently. So what time is it? Oh, we're doing good. Okay. I guess what I will read before I close is just, this is the 12 Steps of Traditions book. I really like the very brief synopsis that they put at the beginning of the book that just talks about the steps and the traditions in a very short format. I'm going to read that. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. What can we believe in? AA does not demand belief. 12 steps are only suggestions. Importance of an open mind. Variety of ways to faith. Substitution of AA as a higher power. Flight of the disillusioned. Roadblocks of indifference and prejudice. Lost faith found in AA. Problems of intellectuality and self-sufficiency. Negative and positive thinking, self-righteousness, defiance as an outstanding characteristic of alcoholics. Step two is a rallying point to sanity, right relation to God. And I really like the way that summary makes all of step two, it just presents all of step two in a very concise way. And what I hope is that in hearing my story and some of the struggles and the ways that I have worked step two in other areas of my life, that people can walk away with a little bit of hope on this Mother's Day weekend. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be here and to be of service. And I wish you all a wonderful rest of your day. And thank you for listening to me.
Thank you so much, Anuwa. That was so lovely.